Hello and welcome to Outside on Burns, and I've got Heather Morey in the studio with me. How are you, Heather?
I'm very good, thank you, John.
Great, and now you're Mountain Safety Advisor with Mountaineering Scotland, is that right?
That is correct, yes.
Mike, I actually got it right. I have a history of getting these things wrong. And what does your job entail? Tell me a little bit about your job.
So the post is funded through Sport Scotland via Mountaineering Scotland, the national governing body for hill walkers, climbers, ski mountaineers in Scotland. And to put it in a nutshell, I essentially look at the Scottish mountain rescue statistics, look at why people get into difficulties in the mountains, and provide education and training to try and mitigate further people getting into the mountains. So in practice, that's running a lot of, in the normal world, it's looking at lots of courses and events for members and the general public to attend and gain the skills and knowledge that they need to be able to go out independently in the mountains and operate safely.
I see. So obviously, so a big part of your role is training, really.
Yeah, absolutely. The majority of the role is training, but I do a lot of work with the media to try and get out some strong, good practice messages to hopefully make sure that people enjoy the mountains safely.
So in your experience, though, you talked about the reasons why people get into problems. What are the couple of the most common reasons you think that people do get into trouble?
Well, statistically, things haven't changed very much over the decades that the mountain rescue statistics, that's a bit of a long word, isn't it? Statistics have been produced, and you're looking roughly about a quarter of incidents, the primary reason is a navigation error, another quarter of the incidents are a slip and trip in the wrong place, resulting in perhaps something like a lower leg injury. Of course, that's pretty simplistic, because often incidents are multifactorial. I was fortunate enough to be on the Cairngorm Mountain Rescue Team for 17 years, and often you would respond to something, and it was, when you looked at the detail of it, it was a catalogue of events that resulted in the final outcome, a bit like kicking off the first domino in a row of dominoes, which one thing led to another. So the stats I've just quoted about navigation and slips and trips might be the primary recorded thing, but actually there would probably be a lot of other stuff going on behind the scenes that resulted in that sort of final call out.
Yeah, it's like, I know exactly what you mean. It's a combination of factors, usually. Like, if someone slips on a climb, or a winter climb or something, that's okay as long as their belay is all right. But if they haven't got a good belay, it all adds to it. And then, depending on where they are, if they're somewhere where they can fall into rocks, then the whole thing, from what is a small slip, becomes a serious incident. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's quite interesting, because some of the activities that we all enjoy, for example, winter climbing, mixed or ice climbing, or indeed summer rock, when you look at the stats, it's a tiny, tiny percentage of call-outs to those activities, which a lot of people would perceive as being very high risk. And the greatest number of call-outs by far is to respond to summer hill walking injuries, and of course it's all a numbers game, isn't it? Because there's an awful lot more people out summer hill walking than there are, for example, going ice climbing in the winter.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I would have thought, people are increasingly using obviously GPS and things like that on mountains. Has that seen a decrease then in people getting lost, or do you think it's not made much difference?
It has made a difference for sure. Technology has really changed why people get lost. Obviously, when it works well and people are able to operate it efficiently, it has huge benefits. But the problems arise, of course, when when it starts to malfunction, and that might be malfunction because of user error, or it might be malfunction because of things like batteries going down or a unit breaking, or often in winter the batteries just can't cope with the cold conditions. So yes, we are seeing an increasing number of incidents based on the fact that technology or the user of the technology has malfunctioned, and they don't have the sort of traditional map and compass skills to back the modern technology up.
Yeah, I mean, there's a different side to that as well, though, isn't it? Because I think that I only read reports in the papers about accidents these days, and you'll know that reports in the papers are ludicrously inaccurate a lot of the time. Yes. But what I'm hearing, or what I'm picking up, or I think I am anyway, is that there seems to be an increasing number of people who will be able to phone for assistance in situation and actually get rescued, or even sometimes talked down in a situation that, in, you know, years ago, before mobile phone technology, a situation that could have been extremely serious. Do you think that happens? Is that true?
Certainly, as the years go by, the ability to use your mobile phone in more and more remote locations is increasing. And because it's becoming easier, and obviously it's a very easy option just to get on the phone and dial 999 and ask for help, then certainly there's some incidents where I think historically people would have self-rescued rather than, you know, someone walking out many miles to the nearest sort of public phone box or habitation. Yeah. So I think mindset has changed. You know, we live in a world now where we kind of, you know, expect an immediate response, and some people will see the mountain rescue services very similarly to that, what they see as, you know, the response from the ambulance, say if you had an accident on the road, and not perhaps appreciate that all the Scottish Mountain Rescue teams are run by volunteers and an unpaid service.
I think I think there's possibly, I don't know, maybe there's possibly an over-reliance on mobile phone technology, because I think if you know, mobile phone can pretty much get you out of anything. But if you're on the hills don't really respect mobile phones too much. I don't know whether this is a trend, but it seemed to me that perhaps what used to happen years ago, I'm going back 30 years, you'd find people very inadequately equipped, you know, just wearing jeans and trainers, that sort of stuff, and they'd get into trouble because of that. And then I think, you know, looking back over my sort of time on the hills, there was a major campaign to say, be prepared. And that kind of message got through a lot. Those kind of rescues of people being very, very dynamically equipped sort of stopped happening. And then, if I'm picking it up right, there seems to be a bit of a trend more recently for people doing that again. You hear about people who are rescued in the Lake District, for example, because they didn't have a torch and it went dark. Is that happening? Are my impressions right, do you think?
I would say that there has always been people who go out into the mountains very ill prepared, and that trend hasn't changed, you know, that certainly continues to this day and has always continued. And one of the big challenges in my role is it's very easy to engage with people who are already kind of switched on to the outdoor media and the outdoor community, and it's reaching those people, you know, to coin a phrase of, you know, the tracksuit trainer clad individual who goes up the, you know, the Bend track, for example, you know, in snowy conditions and comes to grief. It's how do you engage with the people who don't know that they need to know? And
that's right.
You know, it's quite interesting, you know, for people who are seasoned hill walkers and climbers, you know, we very much know how different it can be from down in the glen to up on the tops of the mountains. But again, if you've never experienced that, then, you know, it's hard to imagine, isn't it, the difference between down in Fort William and on the summit of Ben Nevis. And even if you read that it was going to be very different, then, you know, until you've experienced it yourself, it's sometimes difficult to take on board.
Yeah, I mean, well, you don't know what you don't know, do you? And that's I was up at Cape Roth by the lighthouse there last year. Well, as you know, it tends to be a bit drafty now and again.
Yes.
There was a poor guy there in shorts and t-shirt, and he said, I just had no idea it would be like this. So how could he know? If he'd never been to a place like that, how could he know, you know? Can it maybe sort of bring us up to date and talk about what's going on right now? Because obviously we're in a very unusual position. We're in kind of lockdown, we can't go out to the outdoors. And I know that there's perhaps a lot of things happening talking about how we might get back into the outdoors. Where do you think that's at right now? What's happening right now?
Well, as we speak, the current situation is the national governing body, Mountaineering Scotland, is still, you know, as we will always follow government guidelines and work closely with Scottish Mountain Rescue. And currently, you know, we are not able to go off into the mountains. Yeah. But obviously, we're all hoping that, that's going to change sooner rather than later, because, you know, we all, you know, very much enjoy our freedom and exercise and fresh air and all the physical and mental benefits of that. And certainly there has been an awful lot of work going on behind the scenes with all the interested bodies, you know, including, for example, British Mountaineering Council, because it's not just a Scottish thing, is it? You know, if things open up, then, you know, people travel all over the country and from abroad. So work with BMC, Mountaineering Scotland, Scottish Mountain Rescue, Association of Mountaineering Instructors, and bodies such as Police Scotland. We have a big meeting going on next Wednesday of all the sort of key players to look at all the issues involved and how, you know, if the government do allow a bit of leeway and start to lift restrictions, then how we can manage that and not end up with the situation that we saw down on Snowdon, you know, in April, when there were literally thousands and thousands of people, and the aftermath of that with lots of visitors, spreading coronavirus.
Absolutely.
But there's huge problems to overcome, and not least of which is, you know, rural communities, you know, attitude towards visitors. And I think there's going to be some big problems in the future as to how we start to open up the countryside and, you know, people to accept that and not see it as a threat. And
I mean, obviously, I wouldn't want you to preempt the discussion that you're having. So the first thing I'm going to ask you to do is do exactly that. What do you think? What do you think yourself, the first kind of easing we might get? Because obviously, you know, this is a podcast for outdoor people, and most of the people who are listening to this are all chomping at the bit of it. What do you think might be the sort of way it goes first?
Well, I could foresee possibly some sort of tiered system where you can go out with, you know, either your household members or, you know, a very small bubble of, you know, close friends who engage with, the bubble, as people are talking about, in a kind of staged process where you're operating, you know, well within your comfort zone and in low risk, fairly accessible locations. So I could see a kind of tiered system in, you know, put in operation potentially. You know, I don't know, I'm not a decision maker. But, you know, for example, you know, on heading out on lower, less serious hills, you know, fairly accessible, to minimise the potential for having, you know, an accident and therefore having to engage the services of a mountain rescue team. Because none of us think, of course, that we're going to need rescuing. But if we were, you know, in the back end of beyond, in the middle of the Fisher Field, where, it would be a 12-hour stretcher carry or the use of a helicopter, that clearly involves a lot more emergency response than, for example, you know, a walk on a Mealer Buckle, you know, up at Glenmore. I think possibly a stage
so allowing us maybe to go into the safer, more closer, areas that are closer to the road, essentially. So that the,
and
presumably possibly let them travel a little bit. There may be some restrictions on travel, maybe mileage or something like that. I mean,
yes, potentially, but you know, practically, how do you manage all that?
Exactly.
You know, you've got to implement something that is pragmatic and people engage with, and when you start to see, you know, professional footballers training and McDonald's and Costa opening up, it's kind of a hard shout, isn't it, to ask people not to go on the hill with their housemate when they're likely to see nobody.
Yeah, I mean I read the BMC document, or glanced at it anyway, and they were talking about their concerns. And the BMC is a national organisation, but they're probably more looking at the sort of English situation where, obviously, you know, if you do allow people out, you're likely to get large congregations of people in certain areas. But it was talking about things like what it called pinch points. I think like a gate where if people are going on the hill, you might get a lot of people passing through that hill, and that things like that so that could be an issue. Is that the kind of thing that we're looking at?
Well, I think that's certainly a big issue, isn't it? You know, I'm very aware when I'm on my local walks, if I'm going through, you know, metal gates, for example, you know, how I open and close those gates. So I think the whole honeypot thing is something that presents huge issues, you know. And, you know, our obvious honeypots would be places like the Northern Cairngorms and Ben Nevis. Ben Lomond would be a very obvious honeypot. You know, how do we encourage people to sort of spread out into more remote areas and different access points, which is, you know, would obviously, from a prevention of transmitting the disease, be a very positive thing. You know, there's, you know, we're fortunate, aren't we, here in Scotland, that, you know, there are so many places you could walk and literally not see anyone. And
the difficulty, I suppose, is that you know, as you say, that there are places where, you know, you could walk and not see a soul for possibly several days, but there are also places where Ben Lomond and that sort of area where actually if you did ease lockdown, you would get quite congested.
Yes, so you absolutely would. You know, say, for example, you put in place, you know, a recommended, you know, 20 or 30 K radius from your home, and, you know, the mountains immediately around the central bet area would just become, you know, as busy as Socky Hall Street on a normal Saturday. And therefore, you just shift the problem to somewhere else.
It is a very thorny issue. I mean, obviously, you know, I'm a keen bothy visitor, or at least I was up until this. And I'm wondering whether, you know, bringing bothies out of lockdown, I think it's going to be extremely difficult, because bothies, by definition, are unregulated. And it's almost, you know, if you turn up a bothy, you've no idea who's going to be there. You've no idea. There are also small places where it's very difficult to, sort of keep social distance. So bothies might be one of the last places to come up.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? And also, you know, your standards of hygiene in a bothy are often very different to the standards of hygiene at home. And, you know, washing your hands with, you know, soap and water is not as easy to do. You know, and there's many surfaces in bothies, you know, like, for example, opening the door if it's a metal door handle where, you know, potentially the virus can linger for several days. And, you know, they obviously, you know, by their very nature, there's multiple people passing through and nobody knows the background of anybody. And people may be carrying the virus and have no idea that they are doing so. So, you know, all accommodation providers, if indeed you could call the Mountain Bothies Association accommodation provider, facing massive challenges, aren't they? You know, going back to my role about delivering courses, you know, it's all about bringing people together for training, and there's huge implications for that, you know, quite long term, particularly in a residential setting where we often run things from club huts, for example.
Exactly. I mean, I think that what it might bring about, if we could find some way of doing it would be, I can see myself camping a lot more than I have been in the past, and you know, maybe staying in a tent rather than a bothy, because that's a space you can kind of regulate. You think that's a possibility?
Yeah, I mean, I would think it is. You know, you can't get much more socially isolated than taking your tent up the hill, can you? You could be literally, kilometres away. It was interesting. I saw a couple of days ago, I live south of Aviemore, just below the Feshey Hills, and there was a person in a parapont, like way above the Feshey Hills, and clearly they were very successfully socially isolating, but somehow they had obviously gotten there and taken off in the first place. But yeah, camping, bivvying out, you struggle to imagine how you could possibly contaminate other people, but I guess it's all balanced with, you know, what's the risk of getting into difficulties, and implications for, you know, local landowners and farmers on passing through their land prior to getting out on the hill, and it's massively complex, it's very, very emotive.
You're talking about essentially wild camping there, but you know, obviously the vast majority of camping is on campsites with you know, big tents and camper vans, and it's a very different thing. So there may be a way of, because I'm sure all campsites are closed right now, but then again, you know, which is good for the prevention of the virus, but obviously a disaster for small rural economies that really rely on visitors to make their economic life function, you know?
Yes. And I was giving some thought to, you know, if people can't stay in accommodation, then we're going to see potentially when things do start to ease a bit, and huge influx here in the Highlands of mobile homes.
Yes, yes.
And, you know, already we've seen some very detrimental effects in previous summers of, you know, the of too many, and we just don't have the infrastructure in place to cope with that with regards to parking and toileting, etc.
No, that's right.
There
were massive problems with the North Coast 500, which I don't even know whether that'll ever start again. That seems like the sort of last thing you'd want to kick off again, really. Although that's maybe a bit political, but a lot of people traveling in convoys in an area like that does sound to me something that in future we're gonna have to try and avoid. So it certainly opened a lot of cans of worms there, really.
Yes, I certainly haven't answered any questions, just raised an awful lot of questions.
Well, who can right now? I'm very glad that actually the problem is yours and not mine. That seems to me the way it should be right now.
Well, you wouldn't want to be a politician right now, would you? Like making decisions about how we kind of try and safely exit from lockdown. It's
I wouldn't want to be that. And fortunately, I'm in the position that the chances of anybody ever voting for me as a politician are very remote. So I wouldn't vote for me. Anyway, Heather, I've been really nice to speak to you. And I wonder if maybe... in a few weeks' time, or if things get a little clearer, if we know where we're going, I could maybe talk to you again, and we could use this as a way of putting, you know, your views out there on what sort of progress has been made.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be very happy to do that.
Great. Okay. Well, thanks very much for coming on Outside In. That's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
No problem, John. And hopefully we'll meet in a bothy sometime in the future.
Hopefully, if I ever get going, we'll bother you again. Thanks very much, then. Bye-bye, Heather.
Well, as you may have noticed, there were a few technical glitches with the sound there. But I thought, to be honest, that what Heather had to say about where we are in getting out of the lockdown in terms of the outdoors was really important. So I really wanted to get that podcast out as quickly as possible so we could cover those issues. And there was also, you know, for those of you who may have realised, my extremely high level of professionalism. I actually took a phone call in the middle of that podcast. But that having been said, I think that was some really interesting stuff for all of us. Just to talk about what's coming up on Outside In, we've got Mr. Keith Foskett, who's a very experienced through hiker, and he'll be talking about his experiences in hiking some of the great trails of the world, including the Pacific Crest Trail, and talking about really how to prepare for those kind of really massive walking challenges. So he'll be coming up fairly shortly, and you know, do get in touch if you've got anything you'd like to say, and say hello, or if there's a guest you'd want to try me to try and get on the show. Heather Morning came on the show as a direct result of a listener getting in touch. So I do hope to hear from you. I hope you've enjoyed my little podcast, and I hope to see you soon. You take care then. Bye bye.